You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. My guest this week is Jo Farb Hernandez. She's an educator, museum director, and curator, and the author of several books, including Singular Spaces, From the Eccentric to the Extraordinary in Spanish Art Environments. And this book is a work of art in itself. Jo Farb Hernandez, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Start us off by explaining, what is an art environment?
So this is always the problem, defining an art environment. And one of the reasons it's a problem is because it has so many, they take so many different forms and shapes. You can't define them as succinctly as you can define any other kind of genre of art. Like, we know what impressionism is. We know what cubism is. But art environments are, as the title suggests, singular, idiosyncratic spaces that are created by self-taught builders. Most of the time, they don't really self-identify as artists. They just call what they're doing a hobby. And sometimes it's as if this construction is a little bit of creativity that just got out of hand. So somebody might build a bird bath or a little fence, or, wow, that looks great, I'm going to build something else. And the next thing turns out great. And then the next thing turns out great. And 50 years down the road, they've created some monumental series of constructions or a singular construction that can be defined. We're now defining it as a separate genre of art, as an art environment. Although this definition has only really recently, in the past couple of decades, come into play.
I lived in a condo for a little while, and I once put a chalkboard out on the gate in front of my condo in case people wanted to leave me a little message. And I was immediately told to remove this chalkboard, that it violated the
codes.
So these people who make these art environments, do their neighbors ever say, this is no good, you can't do this?
Oh yeah, it's a continual problem. And we've lost many of them. In fact, I haven't gone back to count, but of the art environments that are featured in that book, there's several that are just not there anymore. Because what typically happens is that the artist works on it until he or she dies. And then, you know, the family's like, okay, well, we're done with this. Or the municipality says, okay, well, we didn't bug the guy while he was alive, but we're taking this down now. Or somebody wants to sell the land or whatever. But there are also certainly situations in which the artist has to fight during his or her entire life in order to keep building. There are several sites within that book that either the artist had to stop for a while or was permanently stopped. In one case, the artist went back and built again and again and again, but it's really a problem because they're not, they certainly do not conform to municipal building codes or anything like that. There was one artist that was fined some huge amount. This was a guy who was on Social Security, the Spanish version of Social Security, didn't have a lot of income coming in, got this huge fine from the city because he built dinosaurs that weren't to code. It's like,
is there a dinosaur code?
Right. Is there a dinosaur code for this municipality? Right. So part of what I do is I advocate for their preservation. And I try to get the municipalities and the neighbors to appreciate that this isn't just some crazy thing, but it actually does respond to an entire genre of art that we've now identified, and that they should celebrate it, and they can actually profit from it. I mean, there have been situations in which villages have finally surrendered to the fact that this thing is there and made a big deal of it, and the tourist dollars come in, right? People want to come in and see it. And then they stop at the bar and have a drink, or they stop at the restaurant, or they, you know, spend the night. And so people in these areas have realized that this is actually a good thing. And just because it doesn't conform to those codes doesn't mean it can't be of value to the community.
Do you think that is because as generations change and younger generations come in, they value this more than the older generation did?
Not necessarily, you know, no.
No. Well, how did you get interested in art environments in the first place?
Actually, through my then boyfriend, now husband, Sam Hernandez, we met in Wisconsin when we were in school. He was in graduate school and I was in college, the University of Wisconsin. And we would go out on weekends to visit some of Wisconsin's sites. I mean, they're beautiful, really wonderful sites in Wisconsin. And we would just go out and see them and document them. And then when it came time for me to do my master's thesis, I chose to do them on art environments in the United States. And then when I went to Europe, I documented them there. But it's interesting because the first time I was in Spain, we were in Spain in the 70s, but the first time I was in Spain, well, actually, I think during that time in the 70s, I didn't really think to look for art environments, even though I was documenting art environments in France during that same trip. Oh. And it wasn't really until I was there in the 90s that I kind of looked around and went, oh my God, wait, there's great sites around here. So I started documenting them. But it was because when I decided to actually focus on one of those for a book that I had published about traditional arts, tried to find research on it, there wasn't anything. So I thought, well, okay, this is me, I guess, that, you know, since I've...
If there's a book you want to read and it doesn't exist, you have to write it.
I have to write it myself, right?
Yeah. And so there's a lot of art environments in the United States too.
Yeah, over 1,000.
And in America, are they more or less interested in preserving them or declaring them as art?
I think there's a little bit more recognition of them here. I think both the United States and France have been, you know, more in the forefront of recognizing that this is a genre that should be preserved. But there are still issues. I mean, geez, literally last week, I was writing a letter to the mayor of Los Angeles because they've come up with another harebrained idea of what to do right near the Watts Towers, which is a National Historic Monument. It shares the same kind of status as the White House or any of the other, like Mount Rushmore. And yet they have all these ideas of what they want to do right there that will impact the site. So it's not easy ever. And it's a long-term commitment that the community really has to get involved with. What I've found is helpful is that as an outsider, I can come in and say, okay, well, guys, actually, you should notice that there are other of these sites around the world, and we can, you know, define them and describe them and talk about them, analyze them, and in terms of art history. But as an outsider, if I can partner then with local community groups, that's the best way we can move forward to save sites, because I don't vote in those places, right? The community members vote, and they have taken out mayors or whoever who are not sufficiently protecting these sites because they felt that it was so important for their community to maintain them.
I guess the Watts Towers are the most famous art environment, at least in America.
Yes.
And what is their history, the Watts Towers? Do you know?
Yeah, it was created. They were created by an Italian immigrant, Salvatore Rodia. Started probably in the 1920s, either 1921, 1923, both of those dates are inscribed on the towers. And just little by little, he created these phenomenal, they reach almost 100 feet. And at the time they were the highest non-reinforced concrete structure ever in the universe.
Wow.
So people like Bucky Fuller were very interested in them and supported them. But the city of Los Angeles decided after Rodia walked away from them because Watts had been changing in the 1950s, city of Los Angeles decided that they were a public nuisance and they needed to be pulled down. This was the same guy who arrogantly said to the newspaper, well, if the Tower of Pisa were in LA, we'd take that down too, because it's leaning and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't.
And he's proud of it.
Yeah, he was proud of that attitude. Yeah, so they had a stress test, what they called a stress test, in October of 1959. and tried to pull the towers down. And they went up in 10,000 pound increments. They'd done calculations based on what, like the worst wind or the worst earthquake, et cetera. And what happened at the very end was that the cable on the truck started to break. The power stayed.
So he really knew what he was doing when he built those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So LA is kind of surrendered but they kind of have this love-hate relationship with them and support them and give them some funding, but they haven't given them enough funding. And there are, as I say, always these ideas to, you know, improve the community that will be negative for the towers. So it's like
build a gigantic building around them.
Right, yeah, next to them. Or huge apartment buildings, which was last week's problem.
So this book that we were talking about, Singular Spaces, it's really fortunate that you put this book together, because some of these spaces don't exist anymore. And I'm looking at this book. I mean, you didn't just write a book, which is a great accomplishment in itself. But I mean, this is like a mammoth undertaking, because there's so much involved in this gigantic book. How did it happen, and how long did it take you to put it together?
Well, the first, I started working with this one guy, Joseph Pujula, in the year 2000. And the book was finally published in 2013. and so it was, 14 years-ish of work, although not nonstop work, because I published other books in the meantime, and I was working 2-day jobs and et cetera. So it took longer than it might have, I guess, but I just felt it was really important, because so many of those artists were just unknown beyond their village. There are a couple that had a little bit wider recognition, but very few. And most of the time they would be considered, as like the crazy guy, or this is a folly or whatever. They were not, shall we say, they were not uniformly positive criticisms that appeared in the papers. And it was also hard for me to do it, because most of the anecdotal sources, which is how I found out about them, were not cataloged. So it's not like I could just go to the library and, look through a periodical literature guide or something to find references of these things. So I was just always putting it out there wherever I was about what I was working on. So if I'd be at an art opening, or if I'd be at a lecture for something else, or, meeting new people. Oh, what are you doing? And, I'd explain. And then a lot of times I would, they go, oh, wait, I think there's something that you might be interested in this other village. And that's kind of how it happened.
Word of mouth. So you did the photography, or you have a photographer that was working with you?
No, they're all mine, except for there are a few instances of archival photographs that I had to use from archives, because those sites didn't exist anymore. And from the family, if they had, I'd like to use process shots. So if the family had early shots of the piece in process, I'd love to include those kinds of things.
So what kinds of people, are there hundreds and thousands of these, or tens of them, or what? Are there a lot of people out there doing it?
There's surprising numbers of people doing it. And especially the ones that are in that book, a lot of those had been going on for decades. And that means that they were also even going on during the time that Franco was in power, which is pretty phenomenal to me, because there was such repression. And in certain areas, of course, they couldn't even speak their native languages if they weren't Spanish. And that they would do something which is kind of subversive and kind of outrageous and kind of extravagant at a time when everybody was just keeping their heads down. I really take my hat off to those artists, So in terms of your actual question, which was how many there are, I'm working on a second volume of Singular Spaces now, and I'll have about 100 quote unquote new artists in the book. I thought that with that first volume of Singular Spaces, that was it. That was the encyclopedia done here. but no. And of course, with the publicity surrounding the book, and the fact that I gave a lot of lectures in Spain almost every time at the end of every lecture, somebody would go, oh, wait, in my grandfather's village, there's some guy making something or something like that, right? So that's what propelled me to the second and hopefully final volume of the set.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are talking this week with art historian Jo Farb Hernandez. Her latest book is called Singular Spaces, From the Eccentric to the Extraordinary in Spanish Art Environments. Jo Farb Hernandez, have you noticed among the artists that create these art environments, are there any similarities between them? Are they all men, for example?
In my first book, I was only able to find men, and I looked really hard to find a woman. And my hypothesis was that in a traditional society like Spain, when a guy retired, he was retired, and you know, he'd look for something to do, and so he might build an art environment. But women didn't have that same kind of work history, and they still were responsible for taking care of the grandkids and cleaning the house and going shopping. And, you know,
they don't get to retire. So
they don't really get to retire, and they don't have the extended, broad periods of time, that you would need to really spend your time spending decades on building something. But for this book now, I think I have either six or seven women. Interestingly, some of them either, you know, became widows at a young age or figured out their lives so that, you know, they kept it in their pocket until the kids were, you know, out of school, and then they started, or whatever. They made some kind of accommodation so that they could work. So I'm thrilled that I'm going to have women now. But there's no real, I mean, outside of the fact that many of them started after they retired, quote unquote, because they had more time. But there are all kinds of different reasons people do this. Sometimes it's just because they want to entertain themselves. They don't want to go to the bar, you know. I mean, this one guy said, well, I don't smoke, and so I take the money that I would have spent on cigarettes and I buy art supplies.
And so generally they're older. I mean, you don't find 20-year-olds going out there and building these.
No,
things.
No.
And you mentioned dinosaurs. What are some of the things that you see? Is dinosaurs a common one? Is there more than one dinosaur one?
There are dinosaurs, but there's also like Leaning Towers of Pisa or the Eiffel Tower or a lot of Egyptian references. Egypt has had a strong influence on Spain and elsewhere. I mean, Egypt is always kind of exotic for people. But there are, you know, some are buildings that already existed that have been ornamented, like covered in seashells or covered in tiles or in pieces of broken ceramics. Sometimes they're completely new structures. Sometimes they're just a ridiculous number of sculptures within a small space. Sometimes it's a painting that completely covers the inside or outside of a house. Sometimes it's topiary. So it can just be anything that really changes the personal space of the person who is working on it.
Are they political sometimes or not?
Yes, sometimes they are.
With words?
Yes, sometimes they are. There's a site in France, for example, that is just replete with protest signs. Basically, there's one out in Kansas that is just, the guy is just pissed at everybody. And so he finds, you know, saying how terrible everybody is from all walks of government and, you know, religion. Some of them are more religious. In the States, they're, especially in the South, they tend to be more religious. Spain, not so much, although there are some. And I found, although there was one guy in Spain who felt that he was divinely ordained to create the site. But I found that mostly in Spain, although we have this sense that it's a really Catholic country, it's really pretty secular, and people don't really go to church unless they're going for a wedding or a funeral. Huh. And so when you see a cross, it seems to me to be more a cultural marker than a religious marker. It's like, well, people expect me to put a cross on top of this whatever, so I'm putting it there.
Oh, I will. Uh-huh. And what about, you know, are there monuments to people, you know, like when you see on the side of the road where somebody has been killed in an auto accident or something, and they put a little thing. Is it that kind of thing where they do monuments to people?
Some have started that way. There was one really fabulous site down in southwestern Spain that was, it started as a monument to a guy's partner. They were sailors, and he was he drowned at sea, and so he was so affected by this that he built a museum of the sea in order to honor his friend and the vocation that they had shared.
So when you're going around and photographing and documenting these sites, and you're a curator, or I mean, you've been a curator and a museum director and all that, do you sometimes look at this thing and say, well, you know, yes, this guy's been doing this for years, but it's really junky and ugly and I'm not going to document it? Or do you do it without judgment?
I've actually tried to do it without judgment, and I do get some pain from people for doing that. I just felt that my role with this was to really document the range of the material that was out there. So actually my bigger doubts are when I'm documenting a site that is not as extensive as some other sites. It's like, well, you know, they need another 20 years here, but I'm here now, you know, so.
So maybe you'll go back in 20 years and see how they've
done. Yeah, well, one guy, in fact, I said, because he was telling me about how this place on the side of his garage he wanted to ornament, but it belonged to his sister-in-law, and so he was going to have to, you know, work the deal out. And so I was taking some pictures, and he said, well, why are you taking pictures? I said, well, I like before and after shots. So this is the before shot. And he was really tickled by that. He's like, oh, yeah, well, you'll have to come back and then it'll be great and we'll have the before and after shots.
So what would you say? This book is all the ones that are in Spain. Which do you think is the most spectacular? I mean, if you were going to rate them and say this one is the one, which would be what?
People always ask me that, and I have a really hard time answering that question.
All right, what are the 40 most spectacular ones?
Okay, well, the one that started all of it is really has a warm. I have a warm place in my heart for it still, which is the Josep Pujula's labyrinth and towers that he built. Luckily, only about 20 minutes from our house in Spain, so it was very easy for me to get there and document it regularly. He was the one that had to take it down actually three times, completely take it down for various governmental reasons. But now, due to our incessant harping, it is now a local heritage site, and the county is putting some money there to help keep it clean and stuff, because he died working on site about, what year is this? About five years ago now. Yeah. But there are others that are just really elegant in form. There's one in Extremadura, which is on the western side of Spain, Francisco González's work. Julio Basanta's Casa de Dios, the House of God, which is actually populated more by demons than gods, is really an amazing, amazing site. A difficult site. Visually, a lot of blood and gore.
Oh, wow. And the one that you said is elegant. Can you describe that? What I mean, is it less folk art looking and looks like it's more?
No, it's just that the proportions are really lovely, and his craftsmanship is really extraordinary. Because a lot of these guys started building these because they weren't necessarily builders in their professional lives. And so some of them didn't know what they were doing. And so they were possessed with the idea that they needed to build this thing. And so they built it quickly without really knowing that, well, actually you need to have, there is a certain ratio of concrete to sand that you have to use in putting together a mortar, or you have to make sure that your steel infrastructure is covered so that the moisture doesn't get inside and then cause the steel to expand and then the cement and ceramic to crack and pop off, you know. So there's definitely a range of quality of the work in aesthetic, but also in technique.
And what about the materials? I mean, I would think wood is probably like the most common material, but am I wrong about that?
Actually, not so much. The labyrinth was made out of wood, out of saplings that he found near the little river that ran by there. But I think the most common denominator is that they use what they have or what they can get their hands on easily and cheaply or free. And so a lot of them will hunt the dumpsters, or there used to be dumps in Spain. Now they're not anymore. Now they have what are called clean points. And you can bring your recycles there, but you can't take stuff out of there. Yeah, so they're all very frustrated by that.
That's
fact.
True. But, that's true at most in Watsonville too. I mean, you can't just go to the dump and grab stuff like you used to be able
to. Right. So yeah, many of them will use a brand of concrete called Portland concrete because it dries quickly and it's easily malleable. It's cheap. But a lot of times that'll be the only thing that they'll buy, that is the concrete, because everything else they're able to somehow scrounge from somewhere.
Well, so have you and your husband been tempted in your own environment to start building a bunch of stuff?
I keep suggesting to my husband that he's old enough now to start. So,
but of course you wouldn't want to come home and find him hanging from a 100-foot,
No, I don't even want them up on the roof.
And so they, a lot of them do definitely do dangerous things as they're up there building.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, the guy with the labyrinth and towers. I mean, as I mentioned in the book, I first saw him, literally we were just driving down the road and I saw him hanging from this 100-foot tower that he had built. And I mean, it's a wonder that we didn't actually have an accident. Because we pulled over so quickly. but actually that was part of the problem with that particular site, because it was so compelling that people would turn to look at the towers and the labyrinth instead of the road. And so there was this very high proportion of car accidents right at that. And
so you can see maybe the city didn't want that guy there.
Yeah. And so they rerouted the road and they plowed it right through where he had been building. Because, yeah, and so that was the first time, or the second time he had to take it down. but he started again, so that was good.
Wow, that's insane. So you live half the year in Spain?
Whenever possible, yes.
And so the pandemic has made it impossible for you to go back there.
Yeah, we weren't back last year. I'm still hoping we can get there this year.
Yeah.
Because I still have work to do. I've got about 10 more sites that I know about that I still need to do field work on and document in Spain. In the meantime here, I've been writing like a madwoman. I think I finished my 84th chapter yesterday, my first draft of my 84th chapter for the new book. But I'd like to, that, you know, part of the problem when you have artists that are older is that they are older. And, you know, and a couple of them with the first book died before the book was published. And I, you know, that really tears at my heart, because a lot of times they were not respectfully treated in the literature, as I've mentioned, if they were treated at all. And
it would have been nice for them to see them.
Yeah, it would have been nice for them. So I feel pressure because of that.
There's a time element to get volume two.
Yeah.
Another 13 years between.
Don't say that. No, I've pretty much been working ever since the last one was published. Not right away, because I thought, okay, I'm done here. But within 18 months at least, I was already documenting. And so yeah, 6 years already, I guess, or so, 7 years.
And the publishers want to do another volume, the same publishers?
I haven't had that discussion with them yet. Because these days, you know, you can't just say, unless you're some best-selling writer, which I'm not, you can't just say, hey, I've got this idea for a book. You know, they want to see basically the whole thing pretty much done before they'll even,
Because the book, I mean, I was saying it's a work of art. I mean, it's really, everything about it is great. I mean, the end papers, the whole, you know, the whole way that it's put together. And this is a coffee table book that you could actually use as a coffee table if you wanted. a lot of coffee table books or art books have lots of art and very little, an essay or something, but there's a lot of writing. I mean, this is a big, a lot of writing in this book. I mean, you really wrote a lot. There was no shortcut in telling your story. And is that going to be true with your new book too? A lot of writing.
Yes, I'm closing in on 400,000 words now, and I still have a ways to go. But I just felt it was really important to create a baseline for research, for hopefully future research. And so that first book also, as you'll note, has a DVD included within it. And in the DVD is a complete inventory of every piece in every site, and a photograph of every piece in every site. So so again, so that there could be a baseline of research, because the thing with these sites is that they're constantly changing. And it's not like a painting where you pretty much don't start analyzing the painting until it's done. But done isn't really a word in the vocabulary of these artists. You know, they're constantly working on it. And because for the most part, the sites are at their homes, they're passing it a million times a day. And so they're like, I'm going to move this piece over here, or that looks better over there. Or, you know, what I really need over here is a fill in the blank. And so it's constantly changing. And so you'll note that on my photographs, I always date the photograph, because what it looks like on Wednesday is not necessarily what it's going to look like on Thursday. And so it's important to note that there's no, you know, really one time that this is it until the artist dies.
And when the artist, has it happened that the artist dies and then their son takes over and works on it for another 20 years?
In a very few instances, yeah. In one instance, it was actually the daughter and her husband that completed the castle, in this case, a pseudo castle. Mm-hmm. And seems to me that there's another one that I'm working on now that I can't remember a daughter or son also took it over.
And so when you're done with Singular Spaces too, do you feel like you would want to find another place, like including the United States, to document art environments that have been not documented?
I document art environments wherever I am. So yeah. It's just going to be a question of what happens to that material. I think there's so many little subsets of projects, like I'd like to do a book on Egyptian imagery in art environments, or Eiffel Tower in art environments, or, you know, or expatriates who build art environments. There have been at least about a half a dozen in Spain, that people that are born somewhere else and they come to Spain, it's their new home, and then they make this art environment there. Or women, again, you know, because they hadn't been treated earlier. So I think there are a lot more subsets that I can go to. Not that I'm going to stop, you know, I mean, these days you have your phone with you all the time. And so, you know, you can always shoot whatever you see.
We take more pictures than ever, but we never look at them. Is Mount Rushmore an art environment?
I would say no, although it certainly has many of those characteristics, because it was done kind of within the framework of the mainstream governmental and art world. So you know, my big line here is self-taught, basically. It doesn't mean that somebody can't have gone to art school, but like one of the sites that's the most extensive, and the guy's still working even though he's in his 80s, he was in art school for one semester and got kicked out because they said he didn't have enough drive.
And he's been working now on this
thing. For decades.
And what about the idea of carving into an existing, you know, does that happen too, like Mount Rushmore, where you have a, you know, isn't there a guy that carved an Indian out of a...
It's on a different site near there. Yeah. There's definitely people like to do that. I mean, there's some situations in which there'll be like little graffiti carvings or creations or structures or something that people will leave there. And I think partly also that's because people want to be part of this amazing environment that these people have created. And a lot of times the artists come to conceptualize the work as a gift to their community. And so community members sometimes want to return that favor and make a little something that they'll place in the art environment, you know? what we've had to, the problem that we've run into a couple of times is that, like with Salvation Mountain down in the desert in California, that, you know, if somebody shows up and he goes, okay, well, I'm the new Leonard Knight, I'm going to take over building Salvation Mountain. It's like, no, this is Leonard's mountain, his work, but there's plenty of other space in other places. Go make one there, you know?
Right.
So there's
because,
some of
that. Because that would be basically vandalism of another artist. Yeah. It would be like, oh, you know, the Michelangelo's whatever is beautiful, but I think I could fix it here a little
bit.
Right,
I can fix that here, right.
Well, the book is called Singular Spaces, From the Eccentric to the Extraordinary in Spanish Art Environments. And the author, the brilliant Joe Farb Hernandez, thank you so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure.
Joe Farb Hernandez, educator, museum director, and curator, and the author of several books. Her latest, Singular Spaces, From the Eccentric to the Extraordinary in Spanish Art Environments. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSEO.
Once again, we are joined by From the Bookshelf contributor Lissa Warren. She's the author of The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat, which is a wonderful book. And Lissa Warren has been an insider in the publishing world as a book publicist for many years and has brought some of the best guests that we've had on From the Bookshelf to our attention. And she's always got a lot of interesting new books to talk about, so let's hear what she's got for us today. Lissa Warren, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Hi, Gary.
How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's nice to see you again. What have you been reading?
From Shadows to Life, which is subtitled A Biography of the Cancer Survivorship Movement. It's by Judith Pearson, and it's published by Lincoln Square Books, based in Manhattan.
Well, that sounds interesting. What can you tell us about it?
Well, did you know that this is the 50th anniversary year of the war on cancer? In 1971, with the next election looking less than promising, Richard Nixon knew that he couldn't win the Vietnam War. But there was another war that was brought to his attention. On December 23, 1971, he signed the National Cancer Act, and he declared the war on cancer. In time, the law would lead to safer, more effective treatments, and it in the end saved hundreds of thousands of lives. But it did little to erase the stigma associated with the world's most feared disease. And that's what this book is all about, a group that erased the stigma.
It's interesting because people used to be afraid to even say the word cancer. So tell us about this group.
In 1986, 23 men and women, all of whom had a personal connection to cancer, came together for a weekend summit. Their goal was not to cure the disease, but to instead destroy its myths and stereotypes. The creation of the National Coalition for Cancer Survivorship, the NCCS, that weekend launched the cancer survivorship movement, and it forever changed the way that we look at those diagnosed with the disease. It has succeeded in banning discrimination, it has ushered in survivor healthcare reform, and it has provided researchers with invaluable knowledge about the long-term impacts of treatment.
What's one thing that you took away from this book?
I was really surprised to learn that not that many years ago in this country, people who were diagnosed with cancer were flat out discriminated against, and they were even shunned. Many individuals, sometimes even the patient's own relatives, thought that cancer was contagious, and this ignorance cost people their families, their jobs, and in some cases, their entire sense of self-worth. They were no longer seen as people who could contribute to society, and as if cancer weren't bad enough to have, they were seen as a drain on the country. They were seen as a burden. I mean, my God, we were so uninformed. But that's not my takeaway. My takeaway is that a small but determined group of people actually changed things.
That's an inspiring story. I think it was Damon Runyon, the famous author who wrote the stories that Guys and Dolls is based on, who was the first famous person to announce that he had cancer.
It was so hush-hush. It used to be so hush. And even now people are worried that it's going to hurt their jobs, but it's more out of the closet than it used to be, thankfully.
Yeah. But of course, people are living so much longer now. But I think what happens is, you know, if you live long enough, you will get cancer. If something else.
It seems like it. It does. But at least now we don't have the stereotypes that we used to have. And we have so many more effective treatments, too.
Yeah. From Shadows to Life, A Biography of Cancer Survivorship Movement. And what's the author? Judith Pearson.
Judith Pearson. Yep. And she herself is a cancer survivor, triple negative breast cancer, which is oftentimes a really deadly one. But she has put it to good use. She started a group that women can join that helps them kind of have their second act. That's what it's called, the second act. Get past that awful time when they were first diagnosed and live happy, healthy lives going forward.
That sounds great. Have you got another book for us?
I do. It's called Tough. And the subtitle is Building True Mental, Physical, and Emotional Toughness for Success and Fulfillment. And it's written by Greg Everett and published by Catalyst Athletics.
And who is Greg Everett?
He's an Olympic weightlifting coach. And in the book, which I would categorize as smart self-help, he aims to expand our definition of toughness beyond just physical ability and also beyond the trite notion of resilience. He asks and answers things like, what is toughness? Are men tougher than women? And what is the role of toughness in athletic achievement?
And I mean, I'm pretty tough myself, but how is toughness built?
Through the continuing development of four specific elements. He's real clear about what they are. They are character, which is sort of the who are you, capability, which is what are you able to do, capacity, which is what are you able to withstand, and commitment, which is what are you willing to do.
Why are you bringing this book to us now? Why is this book important right now?
During the pandemic, the mental, physical, and emotional challenges have been unprecedented. We hear that word unprecedented a lot, but it really is, you know, very true. For many of us, it's all just been too much. Depression, anxiety, and other mental health issues are increasing. Weight gain and its associated health risks are rampant. Tempers are short. Relationships are strained. Domestic violence is on the rise. Toughness has been and still is required as we work to get back on our feet. Now more than ever, we need to be tough.
Well, those both sound interesting. How has the pandemic been for authors and publishers and publicists? Because people aren't on book tours. I mean, so how's that affecting things?
It has made everyone's job a lot harder. My heart goes out to authors who researched books and wrote books for years and then thought they would have their moment in the sun and found that, yes, they got their moment in the sun, but the sun wasn't as bright as the sun usually is for authors. They've not gotten as much airtime on radio and television. They've not gotten as much space in newspapers and magazines. And to your point about book tours, those have all gone online. They have all switched to virtual. The good news is bookstores are still doing events via Zoom, but they're not translating into sales as well as they used to. So independent bookstores are still really taking a hit from the pandemic, even though they are trying to do everything they can to stay afloat. And many have, That's the good news. But these indie bookstores really need community support still and are going to for quite a long time.
Yeah. Do you think that's the thing that I think is scary? When the pandemic is over, which will be, I think, Tuesday, is scheduled to end on Tuesday.
Hope so.
Do you think things will come back? That is, do you think publishers will just go, well, we don't have to pay for book tours anymore. They can just do it on Zoom and we won't have to do this part. I mean, in other words, you think they'll just say, well, we did it this way for a year and that's how we'll do it from now on?
No, I think there will be changes back to what we had, because what we're doing right now, it's a stopgap measure when it comes to author tours. What you miss when you don't send an author to a physical bookstore is the opportunity for the author to do local media in each of those cities to which they go. And that is also an important thing to get the word out about books and to make them sell. And also bookstores, they really are going to want to move those events back in store because, you know, you go to a bookstore for an author event, sure, you're going to buy that author's book, but you might buy two or three others and maybe some stationery and maybe one of those little lights that clips to your book so you can read in the dark. You know, there's all kinds of stuff that you buy when you go to a bookstore. So they need the foot traffic. There's that discoverability factor of just walking by a book and seeing a beautiful cover and picking it up and taking it home with you. That they miss very sorely. So I think we will swing back. I hope that we swing back. I miss the bookstore experience very much.
I do too. But I think that even before the pandemic, independent bookstores were suffering. So
yeah, many of them.
Lissa Warren, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks so much for dropping by, and come back again soon.
I will. Bye, Gary.
Lissa Warren joins us every now and then to talk about books. She's the author of a couple of books herself, including The Good Luck Cat, How a Cat Saved a Family and a Family Saved a Cat, and The Savvy Author's Guide to Book Publicity. Lissa also teaches about literature and publishing at Emerson College in Boston.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.